This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker.
The small-town lawyer is becoming a thing of the past.
We found that there were 13 counties in Illinois with five or fewer practicing attorneys, and there were 39 counties in the state of Illinois that have 10 or fewer practicing attorneys.
Hear how to chip away at the shortage of rural lawyers. Plus, Illinois State University scholars take a fresh, dark look at the bleak world of sex and violence, noir fiction. And the new ISU athletic director lays out plans to advance his program. That and a news update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on WGLT.
Support for Sound Ideas comes from Bloomington Normal Audiology, the best hearing device center in the Pantograph Reader's Choice Awards for the sixth year in a row. Bloomington Normal Audiology thanks the listeners and their continued vote of confidence as the leaders in hearing and technology. With a practice featuring five doctors, including two who wear hearing devices themselves, BNA takes a genuine interest in each patient and helps you keep hearing the most important sounds of your life. More information at bnaudiology.com. Bloomington Normal Audiology, here for you.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Let's run down some of the day's top stories. McLean County health officials have announced a new one-day record of 222 coronavirus cases. The county's testing positivity rate topped 11% for the first time in over a month. County Health Department Administrator Jessica McKnight says the county avoided a post-Thanksgiving spike in cases, but the recent holiday break could be different.
We did see probably a little bit more travel in the December holidays. And so, you know, it's something, again, that we're continuing to keep an eye on.
The county also reports five COVID-related deaths. Four of them were associated with long-term care facilities. Democratic U.S. Senator Dick Durbin says President Trump should not attend President-elect Joe Biden's inauguration. Trump announced he wouldn't be attending anyway, but Durbin says he believes Trump lost the right to attend when he encouraged this week's insurrection at the Capitol.
For the president of the United States, Donald Trump, to be there on January 20th, he would be returning to the scene of a crime, and that would be unacceptable to me or the American people.
Durbin also says it's conceivable Congress would vote to impeach Trump before the president leaves office, but it's unlikely. Congressman Darren LaHood says President Trump does bear responsibility for Wednesday's insurrection.
Well, listen, words matter. Words matter from the president. They matter from elected officials. Encouraging people to riot and protest and to go to the Capitol. I mean, those are not things in retrospect that should have been said.
The Peoria area Republican LaHood says he does not support invoking the 25th Amendment or impeaching the president a second time. He says such actions would only further divide a riven country. LaHood says he plans to attend President-elect Joe Biden's inauguration ceremony, and he believes President Trump should reconsider his decision not to attend. Congresswoman Sherry Busto says she's supportive of efforts to remove President Trump from office.
I think we are at the point now where President Trump either needs to prove that he has the ability to lead, or he has to step aside or be removed. I think literally we are to that point.
The 17th District's Democratic representative says she already voted to impeach the president once and that Trump has not improved as a president since. She says he is directly responsible for urging his followers to march on the Capitol as Congress was certifying Biden's election. Busto says she would like to see Vice President Mike Pence and cabinet members, quote, do the right thing by invoking the 25th Amendment to remove Trump from power immediately. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Illinois Congresswoman Mary Miller says she apologizes for any harm caused by her speech that quoted Adolf Hitler at a pro-Trump rally in Washington this week. But the downstate Republican says some critics intentionally tried to twist her words to give the impression she supports Hitler's ideas. Miller faced criticism and calls for her resignation after telling a rally on Capitol Hill that Hitler was right when he said that the key to long-term political success was by reaching youth. Miller says she regrets referring to Hitler, who she called one of the most evil dictators in history. She said she was trying to point out the dangers that outside influences can have on young people. Miller said she is a firm supporter of Israel and the Jewish community and thanked Jewish leaders she had spoken with for their kindness and forthrightness. The head of Southern Illinois University's Paul Simon Public Policy Institute says Republican leaders have a lot of work to do to restore a sense of normalcy to the political process. Wednesday's attacks at the Capitol laid bare a deep political divide in the country. Director John Shaw says the GOP holds part of the blame because so many in the party refused to stand up and correct President Trump when he spread misinformation about the November election.
Republican leaders in Congress knew that he was defeated. And they know that his call to violence was wrong, but they decided that their political careers was more important than, frankly, the honor of their party or their country.
Shaw says there will be plenty of opportunities for Republican and Democratic Party leaders to find common ground as a new administration is sworn in. The Illinois Attorney General is teaming up with the FBI to investigate claims of unemployment fraud spurred by the pandemic. Republican State Representative Mike Marin of Fithian stood outside the Illinois Department of Employment Security's office in Springfield for 2 days last month to protest inaction on the issue. He says the task force is a positive development.
Hopefully they can do some good and help stop a lot of the fraud that's going on out there that is causing a lot of consternation among my constituents and other people around the state, and also probably costing the state a lot of money.
Marin says his district office has been fielding dozens of calls from constituents who have received letters from IDES asking for back pay. Illinois-based Family Video says it's closing its remaining brick-and-mortar stores, including two in Bloomington and two in the Tri-County area. Jim Meadows reports on the last of the national video rental chains.
In 2019, Jeff Peckenham, a Family Video store manager in Springfield, said the chain was holding its own. Speaking on the 21st talk show back then, he said their more than 600 mostly small-town locations attracted long-term customers.
So you have that feeling when you come to a Family Video that it's family, whether it's an employee or just a fellow customer. You just feel at home and it's comfortable.
But this week, Family Video announced they're closing down their remaining 250 stores. CEO Keith Hoagland says the COVID-19 pandemic reduced their foot traffic and also the flow of new movie releases. I'm Jim Meadows.
Connect Transit is seeking public input on its general manager search. Bloomington Normal's transit agency has an online survey that asks several questions, including what are the biggest challenges and opportunities a new manager will face in their first year on the job. Connect Transit has had two interim GMs since Isaac Thorne announced in July he was leaving for a transit job in Knoxville, Tennessee. Former Town of Normal City Manager Mark Peterson is handling GM duties currently. This is Sound Ideas on 89.1 FM WGLT and WGLT.org. I'm Charlie Schlenker.
Support for WGLT comes from Bloomington Normal Audiology. With a practice featuring five doctors, including two who wear hearing devices themselves, BNA takes a genuine interest in each patient. They believe those personal partnerships are how people embrace hearing technology and keep hearing the most important sounds of their lives. More information at bnaudiology.com.
You're listening to Bloomington Normal's Public Media. A new fellowship program will try to chip away at a shortage of lawyers in rural communities in Illinois. The Illinois State Bar Association Rural Practice Fellowship Program will offer incentives to young attorneys and law students to work in smaller towns. Bar Association President Dennis Orsi tells Ryan Denham about the motivations for the new program.
Well, the Rural Practice Initiative was really born from the fact that we started looking at our state, which is no different than a lot of the larger states with large metropolitan areas, and we found that many of the smaller rural communities were losing lawyers. And what I mean by that is we're having a lot of the rural communities that had lawyers that were then getting older and getting ready to retire. And specifically, when we looked at the 102 counties, we found that there were 13 counties in Illinois with five or fewer practicing attorneys, and there were 39 counties in the state of Illinois that have 10 or fewer practicing attorneys. And the hope in the Rural Practice Initiative program was to see if we could come up with a program where we could try to place either soon-to-be graduating attorneys or young attorneys that have recently graduated law school and match them with a lawyer or a law firm in one of these rural locations. And if we could come up with the right match, we would be able to kill two birds in one stone. The expectation was we could help the older attorney with a succession plan by identifying a younger lawyer who could eventually come in and take over the practice. And two, we would then provide that new practitioner that would stay in the rural community and continue to provide services to the community. And so we really looked at it as an access to justice issue, where we wanted to make sure there were going to be practicing attorneys in throughout the state of Illinois that could provide legal services to the residents in those communities.
So you are going to be going after both law students, like those who are still in law school, and as well as young attorneys who've already graduated and are out there practicing. You're trying to recruit both into this program?
The program is really has two components. One is to look for soon-to-be graduating law students who might be interested in participating in a summer clerkship or internship with a practicing attorney or law firm. And the other part of the program is for younger attorneys, graduating attorneys, who have a law license that are ready to hit the ground running and start practicing law in those rural communities. The way we've set up the program, we offer a $5,000 stipend to a law clerk or law student that would come in for a summer internship, if you will. And then we also have a second program where we offer a $10,000 stipend to a practicing attorney if they will come in and stay in a rural community for at least 1 year. And the way we break up that money is we give those practicing attorneys $5,000 up front when they start the position, and if they remain in the position at the end of 12 months, they will be entitled to that second $5,000 stipend.
So what is the attraction for some attorneys to practice in a small town or even their hometown? Is there sort of a romantic notion to that, isn't there, being the small town lawyer?
Well, you know, when we set up this program, we actually did a statewide survey to find out really what's on the minds of these people when it comes to practice in a rural community. And it's kind of surprising. Logically, you think people want to gravitate to the big city. They can make more money, pay off their student loan debt quicker, and, you know, get on to their lives. Unfortunately, what has happened is we're then losing the people that are going to practice law in these small rural communities. But there are really a lot of advantages to practicing in the smaller rural communities. For example, there's a lot of satisfaction people get. I was an attorney that decided I wanted to come back to my hometown. I didn't want to go off to the big city. I felt I could be successful really anywhere practicing law in the state of Illinois, and I have been very successful coming back to my hometown. The video that we've put together where we've interviewed various judges and practicing attorneys around the state of Illinois in some of these small communities say that, you know, they've been very happy with their law practice in the smaller communities. They've gotten excellent feedback from, you know, their clients, and they're very pleased with the income that they're able to make. They're also pleased with the way they can integrate into the community in other organizations. And, you know, it's finding the right people that will find that a rural practice is suitable to them. And we really do think there are a lot of people out there. We're trying to offer them some incentives to get them to focus back on a rural community and be able to have a successful law career.
That's Illinois State Bar Association President Dennis Orsi, an attorney from Granite City near St. Louis. He spoke to Ryan Denham. The first year of the program is a pilot that will likely serve between 5 and 10 fellows between the two tracks. This is Sound Ideas on 89.1 FM WGLT and WGLT.org. A world-weary detective, a cynical femme fatale, a bleak night world of sex and violence, think Humphrey Bogart, Gloria Graham, Dana Andrews, Audrey Totter, and think again about noir. A new book from a pair of Illinois State University English professors poses a new understanding of a classic genre. Correspondent Laura Kennedy has more.
Noir, be it film or novel, is more than we've come to accept through the years. That's the view in a new collection of essays edited by two Illinois State University professors. Noir Effect takes a new approach to the classic genre of noir. Co-edited by Christopher Brew and Elizabeth Hatmaker, the book reveals that noir is more than simply a specific cycle of mid-century American movies or books. Brew explains that the book explores the noir genre through what's known as affect theory.
Affect actually is about the way in which the body is affected by social dynamics and psychological dynamics before we're even physically fully conscious of it. If you've ever entered into a room and felt the mood of that room, that's affect. It's the quality of feeling between people that actually shapes how we respond to each other.
What inspired you to do this book?
My first book was called Hardboiled Masculinities, and it was on the figure of the hardboiled male in 20s, 30s, and 40s, both pulp fiction and also modernist fiction from the period. And so Noir showed up in that. I was married to Elizabeth Hatmaker, the other person who is the editor of this book, and she unfortunately passed away from ALS in 2017. We were both huge Noir fans, and we also worked off of each other all the time. We actually wound up watching a lot of films together, and she had a reading of Noir that I think we developed together. I need to give credit to her because she really said there's a quality in noir that isn't about any of the things that people generally talk about when they talk about noir, you know, whether it's femme fatales and tough guys, or whether it's chiaroscuro lighting or any of those, you know, the canted frame or any of that stuff. She says it's a quality of discomfort. It's a quality of actually being too close to things that are actually disturbing or upsetting or painful or that you don't want to look at. And that became the basis for talking about noir affect, that noir is as a form or as a mode, it's very much about foregrounding things that actually, that we don't want to look at and that disturb us. And the uncomfortable dimensions of everyday life. Everybody keeps trying to find a way of talking about it as a genre or talking about it as a fixed set of approaches, you know, or even as a set of films or a set of books that had a specific historical trajectory. And a lot of people talked about it as an American form, but we kept seeing things that actually were noir or that we felt were noir that didn't fit any of those models. A lot of the most interesting noir isn't necessarily in the genre of detective fiction or even necessarily crime fiction. It can also show up in science fiction. It can show up in video games. It can show up in music. Think about something like Frank Sinatra's, you know, Dark albums. Those almost explicitly play with noir tropes. It can also show up in like Italian gialli, which is a form of Italian films that was borrowed from Italian pulp novels. You know, and then there's the whole French love of it as well. And so we felt like the idea that this could be like pinned down to a specific set of both a specific genre and also a specific historical period, we felt like it didn't do justice to all the work being done in noir, both in the present and the past, that it was much more diverse and that it was actually much harder to pin down, that there was a quality of elusiveness to it.
Christopher, how did you go about selecting your contributors for this?
We wanted to contact people who weren't just going to give us the same old story that we always get of noir that you can find anytime you turn on TCM. We wanted to tell a different story. We wanted to represent the kind of panoply of noir and the kinds of different ways in which the kind of negative affect that we saw as central to noir could be taken and used in different texts.
Why do you suppose right now it's really starting to sink even further into our psyches?
We're living in an economic era, not just in the US, but globally, in which the rhetoric is that self-improvement and self-help and maximizing your self-potential is actually what we're supposed to be doing. And that anytime we fail at achieving our goals, it's our fault. It's nobody else's fault. That, you know, you just need to have a positive attitude. And I think that ideology really becomes limiting and people feel really, really frustrated. And when people fall through the cracks, noir is what speaks to them. Noir actually foregrounds people, you know, it foregrounds the people on the losing end of the economic situation. It foregrounds, you know, the two-time losers. It foregrounds the loners to everyday culture. It actually shows what a lot of contemporary culture wants to cover over. And instead, like, actually has you sympathize with the loser, with the criminal, with the excluded. So that's why I think it actually has an appeal right now, because a lot of people are living very precarious lives, you know, especially since 2008 and the and right now in COVID too. We're living in very precarious lives.
That's Illinois State University English professor Christopher Brew, co-editor of Noir Affect, available from Fordham University Press. I'm Laura Kennedy.
Hear more about Noir Affect at our website, wglt.org. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Illinois State University's new athletics director says the pandemic could have some lasting impacts on college sports. Kyle Brennan tells Eric Stock athletic departments have found efficiencies that could remain even when fans are filling arenas and stadiums once again.
I can't wait for that day. And when we can get fans back and when we can have life somewhat normal. I think what we're going to do is, from my standpoint, is hopefully take some of the things that we've learned out of this and use them moving forward. For example, I think there's a lot of savings that can be made in the way that we meet and interact with each other. Now, for me, there's nothing that replaces the personal and in-person kind of meetings and meeting with folks one-on-one and getting to see them. But I think there's a lot of opportunity we've learned from Zoom and other things to make our lives a little better. So I think it's trying to capture the things that we've learned out of Zoom, I mean, excuse me, out of the pandemic to the best of our advantage. But what it looks like exactly when it ends, not really sure.
So it sounds like you're talking about travel costs being reduced. Where would that be reduced?
Well, you know, there's tons of meetings that take place. And, you know, you go to the NCAA meetings, you go to the conference meetings. There's all different types of things that occur over long distances. And I think that there's some savings that could be had there.
Of course, coaches are all about needing to build and maintain relationships through their recruiting, through the coaches they hire, yep, et cetera. Can there be any savings there?
Yeah, that's a great question. I've talked to some coaches who think it's actually been quite nice to recruit during the pandemic. They can get the family on the phone, have a Zoom, and they feel they accomplish just as much as they do sometimes as going in person in a visit. Now, that's not the same for every coach, but I would look for some of that maybe across the industry as we move forward to limit some of the travel, limit some of the recruiting. I mean, there are some sports that really have no what we call dead periods. So essentially they're allowed to recruit all year. And so I think putting some limits on some of those would be some cost savings that we could do. Obviously, you can't stop competition travel because we need to do that. But the recruiting travel might be a possibility industry-wide, but we'll all have to analyze that as we go.
Will budget cuts or program cuts be necessary as you work through this difficult time where fans are not able to come to games?
Yeah, budget cuts are not in our plan. For us, I've got to come in and understand the budget. I've got to come in and understand the revenues that are coming in and expenses that we have, and I have not had the chance to do that. So I can't honestly answer that question fully because I don't know the finances yet, but I can tell you that my expectation is to come in and try and find ways to avoid those things. So my mindset is not about cuts. It's about how can we improve.
Fans are eager, of course, to return to live sports. But even pre-pandemic attendance wasn't where the university wanted it to be. And maybe this is a problem across college athletics. How do you get more fans in the stands once it's safe to do so again?
Yeah, I think that's a great question because, you know, there are a lot of alternatives for our fans to engage and to watch. But I don't think anything replaces being in person. And I think selling experiences and moving forward, I think that's going to be important for us. Hopefully post-pandemic, I think people are going to be excited for the opportunity to return to congregate and to be together. And so we'll be looking forward to that and take advantage of that as well. But I think what we need to really focus on is making our games an experience.
One of the most visible roles that an athletic director takes on is hiring and evaluating and sometimes firing coaches. How, if you could walk me through your thought process on that, how you go about doing that, and does that change in a year like this where so much is out of place or not where it would typically be?
The world has turned upside down. It's definitely a different year. I think in a normal year for hiring, we're looking at coaches. I've always looked at people who are hungry, who are intelligent, who've done more with less. You know, people who have found a way to be successful where they've been and necessarily haven't had all the resources that they need to be successful. Because when we bring people to Illinois State, we want to put them in a position to have great success. And so giving them the resources they haven't had maybe somewhere else is a goal that we have. But not everyone comes from a different, you know, from a lower resource institution. So for us, we're looking for also intelligent, competitive, hungry people. I've yet to meet a coach who's hungry, intelligent, and competitive who usually doesn't have success. So that's what we're looking for. As far as you know, letting anyone go, obviously that's something you have to look at case by case, and it's not on my radar right now. And in a pandemic year, I think all those evaluations get changed because everything's so different.
And shortly before you came to ISU, the athletics department had implemented an action plan to address what many student-athletes on campus and even some coaches had said was a systemic problem of ignoring the struggles of the Black community, the Black student-athletes and other minorities. You are now left to help implement that plan. So if you can give me your thought process on how you will look to implement the points of that plan.
I haven't had the chance to read the plan. Like I said, I start January 15th, so that's one of the first things that I want to do. So I can't speak to the plan, but I can speak generally to the subject, and I can tell you that One of the things that I really learned from our student athletes on the interview process is that their voices need to be heard, and we need to listen. So for me, it's about getting in, listening to our student athletes, and understanding where they're coming from, trying to bring all of us together, not just student athletes, but us in athletics. And in a broader sense, the university and community, and trying to, you know, get us on the same page and move forward together in a way where we treat everyone with respect and we give our young people the opportunities to be successful that they need. So for us, it's about inclusion and finding ways to build bridges and communities. So we look forward to that when we get to campus.
That was new ISU Athletics Director Kyle Brennan with Eric Stock. He replaces Larry Lyons, who's retiring after 33 years with the university. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT, made possible in part by Bloomington Normal Audiology. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Find Sound Ideas interviews and stories at WGLT.org.